Full Court Fits is The Ringer's new weekly NBA video series hosted by Big Waz, a.k.a. Wozni Lambre. Each week, we take you around the world of NBA fashion and share can't-miss style choices from your favorite players and keep you up to date on the latest news and releases in sneaker culture. Waz also talks to experts like Damian Lillard's personal stylist to give you behind-the-scenes looks at how the NBA's biggest stars choose their outfits. New episodes drop every Friday, so make sure you're subscribed to The Ringer's YouTube channel at youtube.com/TheRinger so you never miss an episode.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on Hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier, thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive, or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hello and welcome to the Ringer MLB show. My name is Michael Bauman and I'm a staff writer at the Ringer, and I have to work against muscle memory because Zach Cram is not here with us today. I'm joined by the old reliable, the man who never goes on vacation, Ben Lindbergh. How you doing?
Hi, I'm doing all right. This takes me back to when Zach was still in middle school and this used to be a two-person podcast.
I was thinking the same thing, that it feels so weird to do this without Zach now, but you and I podcasted together, just the two of us without a net, for like 3 years. And
yeah, somehow we made it work, man, despite our many feuds.
I'm going back all the way to all the bad decisions I made in my youth, because it definitely feels uncomfortable doing this. Zach, I think we'll be back next week, right? He's taken vacation to the 1860s, and so is out of touch. So we've had to do more of the organization on our own, and I don't like it. So please come back soon. Also on vacation, Bobby Wagner, who I don't give a damn if he ever comes back, because in the past 4 days, the Phillies have made up 3 games on the Mets in the NL East. So Bobby, now that Bobby's not around to drive the Mets, things are going more my way. So take all the time you need, big guy. all right. We'll start with some news. You know, we saw some promo shots of some fancy new uniforms. And obviously, Ben, you're the person to talk to about baseball uniforms.
Yes. Go-to guy.
Yeah, for the Field of Dreams game, which is going to be next week between the Yankees and the White Sox in Iowa. It'll be nice for people in Iowa to be able to watch a baseball game, since every team in the country is blacked out on MLB.tv there. Ben, what's your take on these promo shots and this special event?
So obviously it's a stunt. It's kind of contrived, but generally I'm in favor of playing baseball in as many places as possible and playing Major League Baseball in as many places and strange settings as possible. So in that sense, I like it. I think one of the strengths of Major League Baseball compared to other sports, other leagues, is the eccentricities of the playing surfaces and the dimensions and the way that you really get a sense of place. And so playing in a cornfield in Iowa, I think, goes along with that. And I kind of have mixed feelings about the inspiration for this event, Field of Dreams, the movie, which most people, it seems, either have strongly against feelings or strongly for feelings. And somehow, even about that, I found a middle ground and just kind of generally enjoy it, despite thinking that it's totally ridiculous and also sends some very strange messages, frankly. But I kind of enjoy it for its ridiculousness. And so most people, it seems like, you know, either they can't tolerate it or they break down sobbing because it reminds them of their dad or whatever.
But right.
For me, it's neither. And so I don't have as much emotional baggage on either extreme tied up in this event. So I guess I'm generally looking forward to it. And I saw a picture of Lance Lynn wearing an old timey uniform, and it really seemed to suit him because he has the old timey body type. So
he does not have the old timey body. Do you have any idea what, like, the average Major League Baseball player in 1919 was like 5'4".
To scale, like,
they
though.
They put Lance Lynn in a circus if he showed up.
He's twice the size, but in terms of his rotundity or his dimensions, you know, he doesn't necessarily look like he has taken advantage of all of the latest training methods and advances, although maybe he has. So
in that sense,
you know, he looked like, I don't know, late career Babe Ruth or something wearing those unis.
You may not like it, but this is what peak performance looks like.
So
I think it's a stunt, but I think it's fair to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the editorial stance of this podcast is broadly speaking pro stunt, right?
Yes.
Like So it's cool. You know, it's a long season. You might as well do something interesting. I think, you know, it's silly, but I'm enjoying the Craig Kimbrell with his arms out looking like a scarecrow in the middle of the cornfield, that shot that circulated on Twitter this morning. It's cool. Of course you're the one person who's got middle ground on Field of Dreams. You know, it's a movie that I think speaks to a certain generation of baseball fans because it's about the stunted emotions of male relationships.
Yes.
Like, men will literally bulldoze their cornfield and build a baseball stadium instead of going to therapy.
Yeah. Do we still need Field of Dreams in the post Ted Lasso era, or maybe we've moved beyond
I mean, there's that. You and I are geriatric millennials. I was going to say our checklist to get to these things was like Good Will Hunting and Everybody Wants Some, and the one song from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend about how you need to use sports analogies to talk about feelings with your dad. I think that gets us to the right place. There is one line that I think really illustrates, you know, speaking of, you know, stunted male relationships where we can't, you know, really talk about our feelings. It illustrates, I think, our friendship, or at least your feelings towards me. And this is from Terrence Mann. I'm going to beat you with this crowbar until you go away. You know, that's something that I think is really, really captured our working partnership.
Well, I am glad that at least for one thing, the game, the Field of Dreams game, is not segregated, unlike the game in the actual Field of Dreams.
Yeah, no kidding.
I am disappointed, though, that there is an outfield fence. It seems to me that you should just play with the cornfield. And if you hit it into the corn, then you have to venture into the corn and disappear. And
yeah.
That, I think, would be really, you're not taking advantage of the cornfield if it is roped off, if it's off limits. So I think that should be playable.
Yeah, I think that's a ridiculous take because, like, you saw the movie, right? Like, oh, it's a deep fly ball to right field and Aaron Judge goes back into the corn and disappears and goes to purgatory.
Yes.
Like, the Yankees have to play in the pennant race after this.
Yeah, they can't risk outfielders.
Yeah, they can't risk losing people to metaphysical curiosities like the ghost cornfield. One last thing is about Field of Dreams and its sort of generational impact. And I think, you know, maybe our generation, like you said, doesn't have that strong relationship, which is why, like, you and I think both sort of think it's hokey, but don't find it, like, offensive the way, you know, Craig Calcaterra writes about how hokey Field of Dreams is all the time. But I do think it's ripe for a remake because it's been 30 years. And so what that means is, like, you get the boomer dad. Maybe this relationship is literally Ray and Karen from Field of Dreams, the boomer dad who's obsessed with Pete Rose. And then instead of the fight over the Vietnam War, they have the fight over, like, Occupy Wall Street or something. And then Karen goes off and they never talk again. And then, you know, and she says, you know, Pete Rose was a real piece of shit. And she goes off and discovers that he was a real piece of shit. And Ray, instead of bulldozing his cornfield for a baseball stadium, bulldozes it again for a portrait of Donald Trump. And that's the boomer dad millennial kid.
Yeah, speaking of Craig Calcaterra, he did a great pitch. I subscribed to his newsletter, and on Thursday, he came up with a pitch for a sequel to Field of Dreams, in which Gabby Hoffman would reprise her role as Karen Kinsella as an adult now. And I won't spoil the entire thing, but I think it was actually a pretty good idea. And Terrence Mann still with us, so he can be in the movie. And in Craig's conception of the movie,
he's not. He goes and disappears again.
Well, yes,
like,
he does.
It's the whole point of the cornfield. He's not alive at the end of the movie.
I mean, he's with us in real life, so conceivably he could be in the movie in some
way. And this is how I can tell that you've basically never left New York City, is you don't know not to walk into cornfields if you want to walk out the other side.
That's true. I have done a corn maze in my life. I enjoy a good maze, but
I love a corn maze.
Yeah. In Craig's conception, Ray and Annie have long since gone their separate ways, which I think is probably what would
accurate,
happen if you have seen the movie.
Tour de force by Amy Madigan in Field of Dreams. And whatever else you could say, really underrated performance. All right. Mm-hmm. The other big news of the week, Max Scherzer. Well, I guess some of the big news of the week, Max Scherzer made his Dodgers debut, pitched very well, left to a standing ovation, got a curtain call. And the Dodgers also signed Cole Hamels, who's been on the shelf really for about a year and a half since he had trouble breaking into the Braves rotation last year. And you came up with a pretty funny premise for what this means for the Dodgers roster construction.
Yeah, get the gang of aces from 2013 back together. It's like from this spring when people were joking that the Orioles were trying to assemble 2013's greatest rotation with Matt Harvey and Felix Hernandez. And the Dodgers are doing that, except with guys who are still good. So they still have Kershaw, of course, and they have David Price, and now they have Scherzer, and now they have Cole Hamels. So they are collecting a lot of the best pitchers from about 8 years ago. So I was wondering who would be next, which 2013 ace would you stunt cast as a 2021 Dodger?
Well, this is a tricky question because they've already had most of those guys already. Hyunjin Ryu's been on the Dodgers. Dan Heron's been on the Dodgers. Matt Latos has been on the Dodgers. Homer Bailey's been on the Dodgers. Zach Greinke's been on the Dodgers. Yu Darvish has been on the Dodgers. Hiroki Kuroda was my, big. Loved Hiroki Kuroda.
Me too.
But also was on the Dodgers. So they've done this already.
Yeah, no, you make a good point. There are some guys still floating around. I guess they missed their chance to sign Scott Kazmir, let him go to a division rival and to the Olympics.
No, he's been on the Dodgers already.
That's true too. Yeah, I guess he's another one. John Lester was there for the taking. I don't think you really want to take him anymore. Like, who is still good from 2013, who is still active and pitching for some other team? I guess Adam Wainwright is still around, although it's hard to imagine him pitching anywhere other than St. Louis. And then you've got injured guys or guys who are on the comeback trail, Justin Verlander, Chris Sale. Like, there's plenty of time for Chris Sale to be a Dodger at some point. Not this year, obviously, but when he's 37 years old, then he'll probably be the lefty bullpen guy for Los Angeles. So I could see that happening.
Yeah, I think Verlander's the serious pick because he's going to be a free agent this year and may very well want to come back. You mentioned the Adam Wainwright sort of playoff baggage being fraught. I don't know if that's any more or less true with him than Hamels, considering those two NLCS, which were so far in the past. Cole Hamels was still basically a child. Clayton Kershaw was literally a child for this. I would bet my bottom dollar that Corey Kluber ends up in a Dodgers uniform at some point.
Yeah.
Like, that just feels like it's kind of incredible that that hasn't happened already.
Yeah, they love taking a flyer on the injured guys. Yeah, that could happen.
I'd love to see them dig up CJ Wilson.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are some guys I'd love for them to bring back into baseball, like Ubaldo, I think, technically retired last September, but could he come back in a bullpen role for the Dodgers? Maybe they rehabilitate Ubaldo. That'd be fun.
Yeah.
Bartolo Colon.
Yeah, Bartolo Colon. Is he not pitched for the Dodgers already?
I don't think so.
I just sort of assume that Bartolo Colon's pitched for everybody, but I guess that's not literally true. Steven Strasburg, not now, but in about 3 or 4 years when he's sort of mm-hmm. on the back end of that contract, and they get the Nats to eat a lot of salary, and he comes back and puts together one mostly healthy 25 start season, and the Dodgers win the World Series again. I think you can write that in ink in your on, in your calendar around 2025 or so.
That's a solid pick.
When I was going back and looking up the names, you know, in the effort to remember some guys, I noticed something interesting on Baseball Reference, and that's, it's this: 36 pitchers threw at least 200 innings in the 2013 Major League Baseball season.
How many are we going to get this year?
I don't know. If it's more than like a dozen, I'd be surprised, frankly. I mean, I don't have the numbers up in front of me, so I'm sure there's, you know,
yeah.
If Zach were here, he would have an actual educated guess about that, but.
Yeah, I mean, even in 2019, it was, I think, 15 guys got to that point, and it's going to be fewer this year.
We're going to get to the point where we're not going to get 36 guys to qualify for the ERA title in the next couple of years. And that list of some of these guys weren't all the way up at 200 innings, but they were close. I think Travis Wood finishing exactly 200. Kyle Kendrick was in the 180s. You'd never let pitchers like that throw that many innings. And like, this was not that long ago. This was, you know, half the rotation of the World Series favorite was in its prime while this was going on. And it's, I don't know, it's baseball's evolving so quickly, it almost defies the boiling frog metaphor.
Zach Wheeler is the major league leader in innings pitched as we speak, and he's on pace for 220. So that's the ceiling now.
Yeah. And I think Wainwright pitched in the 240s a couple years before that. Felix and Roy Halladay pitched up to 250, which I don't think anybody's done since. It's, baseball is a land of contrasts. It's a fast evolving thing. You know what's not evolving quickly? What is the alpha and the omega, the fixed point? Mike Trout. On Saturday reaches a milestone. Mike Trout, who has been 24 years old since about 2011 or so, turns 30 on Saturday. Happy birthday to the Millville Meteor. Ben, what are your emotions about this? This is a big moment. He also reached the 10 years of service time. I think this week, he's eligible for Hall of Fame induction, having played in 10 different championship seasons. So, man, what a time to look back on, the greatest player of the generation with still maybe another 10 years left in his career.
Let's hope if he ever gets back from this career-threatening calf strain, which seems to have sidelined him for longer than anyone could expect. But hopefully that will be a blip in the long run.
I think that's a really, really ideologically or logically consistent position for you, a good hill for you to stake out. And fortify being the biggest Shohei Ohtani fan on the planet and think, talk about how one guy who's gotten hurt a couple times is son. Oh man, he's never going to be the same after a pulled muscle. Have you seen how many muscles this guy has? It's obviously he's going to pull one every so often. It's fine. He's not going to be the nailed on 10 war a year guy that he was in his early 20s, but let's not act like, this is late career Mark McGwire.
Oh, sure. He was off to the best start of his career before he got hurt. So it's just a matter of how often he'll stay on the field and whether this is a prelude to a more injury-prone 30s. Let's hope not. But we're looking back, at least for now. We can look forward in a few minutes. And yeah, it's been an incredible 10 years. It's been about the best baseball decade ever. And July 8th, 2011 was when he made his Major League debut. So we passed the 10-year anniversary of that less than a month ago. And Mike Trout turning 30, I mean, that makes me feel old. Obviously, we are older than 30, but Trout, just because he came up and we got to know him when he was so young and so good and had just turned 20 in his 2012 season and was already the best player in baseball. Like, for me, that's kind of how old he'll be forever in my mind's eye, even though he is obviously aging in real life. But you couldn't have asked for a better 10 years, and you could have asked for a much better 10 years for the Angels, obviously, but Trout did as much as he possibly could have. And it's funny you mention Ohtani, because Trout, until Ohtani came along, was the player who had given me the most joy over the course of several seasons over my time covering baseball professionally. not just watching him on a day-to-day basis, but just kind of marveling at the accomplishments and the pace and the stats that he put up and how few weaknesses he had and how many strengths he had. And the shape of his production has changed over the years. He's kind of been a few different models of Mike Trout, but they've all been incredible, including the current model when he's healthy. And so it is very surprising that someone came along on the same team and eclipsed him in my eyes when it came to my affection and how close the attention I'm paying to him is. But I don't want to discount just how much joy he has given me and most baseball fans over the last decade. It's been an incredible career, and hopefully that career is only about half over.
Yeah, the point about the shape of his production changing, I think that is, it's a little bittersweet. I think this was always something we sort of suspected about Trout, just based on his physicality and the way, you know, baseball players age, which is that as time went on, he was going to become, you know, less of an all around, you know, speed and power guy, more of a power on base guy. And that's definitely borne itself out. But it's a little sad that we, you know, that first year he led Major League Baseball in stolen bases. And, you know, we're never going to see that 50 steal Trout again. I don't know if we're going to see like the 25-30 stolen base Trout again. And that, you know, that's sort of, you know, that one Eric Davis season that everybody hangs on to. What was it, like 37 home runs and 50 stolen bases? Like, that seemed like Trout could have done that. And some of the injuries he suffered, and there was a broken thumb from sliding into or diving into second base.
Right.
Like, you know,
yeah, I was going to say it's not as if he's slow now. He is still among the fastest players in baseball. And at least according to sprint speed, he really hasn't lost that much, at least high end speed in the last several seasons. We don't have his sprint speed from 2012. And I'm guessing he was faster then than he is now. He's, you know, still a speed demon. But I think part of it is just that when you hurt yourself sliding a few times, and also when you develop as much power as he has, then kind of the cost benefit analysis, you know, the calculus of, do I actually want to risk myself for this one base here when I could be costing myself weeks or months if something goes wrong? Ultimately, a lot of guys follow this type of progression. So now we're watching Tatis and Acuna, you know, when those guys are healthy, at least they're kind of your power speed threats, whereas Trout is mostly a power threat who still has a lot of speed. He just doesn't show it as much, at least on the base paths.
Yeah, and that might be like a microcosm for watching Trout, that, you know, there's something, you know, it all you can tell watching him how great he is. Like, there's very few players, at least for me, that I can, like, you could see them thinking through the act of tracking a pitch, where the pitch recognition and the strike zone discipline and the bat control are so good that, like, you could see how early they make the decision. It's like Trout and Soto and Joey Votto and maybe, you know, maybe one or two other guys. And that's always been the thing that it really stood out to me most watching him, that, you know, for somebody who's one of the most physically gifted athletes to play this sport, definitely now, maybe ever, for, you know, that his greatness has always been kind of subtle. Like, you don't see the Fernando Tatis, you know, trying to come home from second on a ground ball, or that double jump, or, you know, and he doesn't do the, you know, he hits a ton of home runs, but they're not 470 foot tape measure shots like some of Ohtani's. And, you know, it's interesting because I was trying to think of, like, you know, what's the iconic Trout highlight? And
it's a tough one.
He's got a very distinctive way of moving. So it's easy to come up with a physical, you know, to come up with a mental image of watching him play. Like, I'm never going to forget what he looked like hitting, running, throwing, and so on. But, you know, maybe it's just that the Angels haven't had that, you know, that big postseason moment with him on the roster. And I guess we could talk about that again, you know, do our bi-monthly, like, come on, Angels, get your shit together thing. But, you know, it's not like he has the one 500 foot home run or the scoring from first on a single or something like that, the Willie Mays catch, you know, and I don't know if he's got something like that where it's going to be the definitive image of Mike Trout.
I hope that's still ahead, and I hope it comes in October, because the 1-for-12 performance in the 2014 ALDS didn't really make a lot of memories, although the one was a home run, so that's something. But yeah, everything he does is sort of understated. I mean, I don't want to overstate how understated he is, because like sometimes he will hit balls a really long way, and sometimes he will beat out a ball that it seems like someone his size has no business beating out. So like his raw tools are really impressive, obviously, but I don't think it's quite as clearly in comparison to Ohtani, as you said. Like he doesn't have the classic sweet home run hitter swing. Like it's kind of a quick cut, you know,
it's very short, efficient. It reminds me of Chase Utley, like a mirror image of that. Yeah, like all like short arms direct through the zone and just, you know, no wasted motion.
Yeah, it's not really a distinctive stance or swing. Like if you're a little kid and you're imitating the batting stances, like Trout, it's just so balanced. It's like the platonic ideal of a perfect baseball swing, I guess, but that almost makes it a little more forgettable or less salient in a way, just because it doesn't have any strange characteristics. It's like just the perfect swing distilled down to its essence or something. So I had a hard time thinking of highlights too. I mean, he does have some like home run robberies is something that he has excelled at, especially earlier in his career. So I guess the signature Trout play would probably be the 2012 home run robbery off JJ Hardy, which that gets replayed a lot. And he also had the one in 2019 where he robbed Christian Yelich, which was kind of cool. Like, I don't think it was his best robbery, but it was cool because Yelich was the defending MVP or reigning MVP, and Trout was a multi-time MVP. And so it was sort of like that Torrey Hunter robbing Barry Bonds in the All-Star game moment where, you know, the hitter is just kind of smiling and tipping his cap, which Yelich did to Trout. So those are the ones that come to mind for me. But really, it's a career that can't really be measured that well just with individual plays. It's almost like the career highlight of Mike Trout is like looking at the WAR leaderboard or something, sorting by WAR, which is not a very dynamic image. But that's what I think of with Trout, because it's just the steady accumulation of value, more so than the individual draw chopping play.
Yeah, I'm going to draw sort of a weird comp. Like he's sort of like pre-steroids Barry Bonds, where the numbers are just eye popping and the tools are just eye popping. And obviously, he's one of the, this is sort of an interesting question for me, is where Trout ranks right now among the best baseball players who ever lived. And, you know, so like, I want to talk about that, but in a couple minutes. But like, you know, when you think of Barry Bonds, it's all late career. It's all, you know, the home run off Eric Gagne, or even like the home run swing where, you know, where he's slamming the bat down.
Upper deck home run too.
Yeah. You know, quick through the zone, bat on the ground, is, you know, is cross earing, like, you know, waggling in the post swing effort or whatever. And all that came late for Bonds, including the postseason run that everybody had been waiting for. And I think this is something, particularly before the playoffs got expanded, it was very, very common for players, insofar as any of them exist, for players like Trout to go their entire careers without any kind of notable postseason memories. Like Ted Williams, you know, had the one game playoff and one World Series, which the Red Sox lost, and he didn't play particularly well. And so, you know, maybe this is something, and it's not even like, I don't know, you think about great athletes who never won a title in American sports, like, you know, like Charles Barkley, for instance, or Dan Marino. And, you know, those guys all got way closer to a title than Trout did, or Trout has so far, I should say. But, it, you know, this was not an uncommon thing to happen to baseball players. And that's sort of the class of athlete that we're looking at here is like Ted Williams. Like that's the, you know, the kind of player you have to really compare Trout to in terms of what they've been able to accomplish on the field. And it's, you know, it's less unusual than we might like to think, for athletes like that to go their entire career only having maybe one shot at a title.
And in a way, it's a useful object lesson. It's unfortunate that it comes at the expense of Trout, but just to convey that this is how baseball works, that you can have one of the very best players of all time and still almost never make the playoffs. I mean, that's something where some people might see that and conclude that Trout must be overrated, that he actually couldn't be that good, or he would have single-handedly carried the Angels to the playoffs. But I think we would say that, No, it's not a reflection on Trout. It's a reflection on the rest of the roster, and that's a whole topic for another podcast about how the Angels.
If nothing else, it's useful because it means you don't have to take those people seriously about baseball.
Because that's true, and you can just point to Trout and say it takes more than one guy, even if that guy is absolutely the best guy by a mile for much of his career. That's not enough. And in the Angels' case, even spending on some other prominent players and bringing them in has not been enough, which at this point obviously is a failure to have incredible talents like Trout and Otani and to not be able to get them to the playoffs. But it does point out one of the differences between baseball and, say, basketball, where you could go get one guy and that could propel you to the playoffs. And that just, it doesn't work that way in baseball.
Yeah. And that's something that, like, I really like about baseball. I think it, like, it's something that I really connect with on an emotional level, is that you can't just, like, bootstrap your way to success, that no matter how good one person is, it doesn't matter if the other 24, 25 people on the roster aren't. And, you know, it's about collective achievement and, you know, one person, you can't go ISO, or you can't, you know, return the kickoff for a touchdown. You can't skate coast to coast the way you can and score the way you can in other sports. Like, you can get on base, but somebody else needs to drive you in. And that's, you know, I think that's just a one, like, I think it's a useful reminder that this is a sport where the most common outcome is failure, like, overwhelmingly. And it's good to be able to learn to accept that and put it into context. But also, you know, it illustrates the importance of even Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani have to rely on their teammates. And, you know, it's useful to remember that when you have success, and, you know, remind yourself that your teammates were what got you there, but also to, you know, put failures in context and remind yourself that so much about this game is not within your control. And if, you know, if it were, then the Angels would have won the World Series every year. Yeah. But that's just not how the sport works.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com. This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. I was traveling internationally last year. I was in Mallorca. I didn't know the island well. I said, let me head to the north, head towards the water. Let me go on hotels.com and see what they have available. Something preferably on the beach, maybe even a gym. Not only did I get those things, there was a kids session with exercise, gymnastics in the water, pony rides, a train. It had everything, and I didn't even want any of those things. But at least I knew they were there, just in case I changed my mind. And now finding the perfect hotel has never been easier thanks to the Hotels.com app. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly, right, all-inclusive or a relaxing spa weekend, you can find exactly what you need and compare hotel prices, ratings, and amenities side by side. So start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app.
I meant to mention another reason why he maybe doesn't pop off the screen the way that some other players do is that a lot of his value is tied up in his plate discipline, which is among the best in baseball. And I don't know if that's an unsung skill in this era, but it's not the most visually riveting one. You know, you don't tend to see highlight packages of good takes, let's say. But
you don't, but you can see it. I mean, this is sort of what I was getting at earlier, is that if you don't see it like, I don't know, like the 370 on base guys, you know, you don't see the great play discipline, but you know, there's a very, very select few where I think you can, if you're looking hard enough, you can, like it does like come off the screen, you know, like I mentioned Votto and Soto and guys like that, or Bonds, you know, to belabor that comparison, you can see them processing information differently than most other people. Most other hitters can. So I think, you know, Trout is, I think that's generally true, but I think Trout is so good at it that you can actually see it just sort of casually watching the game.
True. And another Trout highlight you tend to see is, you know, he's a low ball hitter. And so sometimes you'll see him hit a ball that's like ankle high or something, and he'll hit it 430 feet and you wonder how he did that. So that's sort of a signature Trout thing for me too. So should we talk about where he stands right now? Obviously, he's going to add to his legacy, hopefully a lot in the years to come. But the thing about Trout is that even though he's just turning 30, you can already compare him to some of the best players ever.
He was so good at such a young age that, like, we've been making this comparison making comparisons like this for, I don't know, like 5 years now. Like, once it became clear that one great 2012 season wasn't a fluke, that we were dealing with somebody you don't, a literal once in a generation player. And so I don't know, like the way I'd put it is this, if you want to take, this is sort of a complicated question once you get into, you know, guys like Josh Gibson and Oscar Charleston and Sadaharu Oh, who didn't play in the majors. But if you want, if you asked who the best player in, or sorry, who didn't play in Major League Baseball, quote unquote, if you ask who the best player in MLB history is, I think there are three answers that I would accept, and Trout's one of them.
Yeah. I mean,
maybe that's a little aggressive, but like I think that's the territory he's in.
For years, we talked about the, you know, best war through age X stat with Trout, which he no longer holds that top spot just because of the pandemic, shortened season, and because of his injuries over the past few years. But even if he doesn't play another game this season, he already ranks fifth all time in war through a player's age 29 season, according to FanCraft's, and the guys ahead of him are all from long ago, in most cases very long ago: Rogers Hornsby, Ty Cobb, Mickey Mantle, Babe Ruth. So to do that in this era against this kind of competition, I think he still has a legitimate case for being the best ever through this age. And, you know, you look at where he ranks on the all-time leaderboards. I mean, even at Baseball Reference, where his career WAR is slightly lower, you know, he's over 75 at both of those sites. And so the players he's next to are pretty much all Hall of Famers at this point, you know. And if he retired today, he would be a Hall of Famer too. He has already had a Hall of Fame career, and hopefully it's half of a Hall of Fame career, so that he ends up with Ricky Henderson, where, you know, the line about how you could cut him in two and have two Hall of Famers would apply to Trout too. And that's a big question, obviously, and there's a lot of uncertainty about that, because you just never know how any player will age. And Trout, with his durability problems in recent years, that doesn't seem like the kind of thing that would get better, or that you'd expect to get better as you get older. So who knows? Like, maybe you can just double his WAR right now and that's his career, or maybe he'll tail off dramatically. Who knows? But it would not at all surprise me if he had an Aaron or Mays type career where he was still hitting really well at, you know, age 39 or 40 or whatever, even if he's more limited as an all-around player. And, you know, I don't know how long he'll be a center fielder. Like, I think he is still perfectly competent as a center fielder, but not a standout center fielder. And I even saw some suggestion that if and when he comes back this season, they might put him in a corner temporarily just to not stress the calf. And I wonder if that happens, whether that might just sort of segue to the next act of his career where he is more of a corner guy. But, you know, it's going to be years until he's an all-bat player. And even when he is an all-bat player, if his bat is any sort of semblance yeah. of what it is now, like, he's going to be good for a really long time.
Yeah, I mean, this is superstar offensive production for a DH, and it comes from a guy who's, you know, he's not Willie Mays defensively, but a competent defensive center fielder who's also earlier in his career was stealing a lot of bases too. And that's like what really put him over the top. And I think what separated him from, you know, his potential from to use somebody who is contemporary has grown up, Bryce Harper. Where you knew, you know, maybe the offensive production would be just as good or better, but it was coming from a corner. So it's, you know, just a slightly different type of player. I do think that there's a possibility that his decline phase will sort of, get me to back off that really aggressive statement I just made, you know, where I put him in a class with Ruth and Bonds and that's it. We've seen this with, just to name two other all-time greats who currently play in the Los Angeles metropolitan area, you know, Albert Pujols and Clayton Kershaw, when those guys fell off their historic pace in their early 30s, sort of changed the way we evaluated them from, you know, one of the handful of the best ever to, you know, you look back at the career and they're just your garden variety first ballot Hall of Famer. I think that there is a possibility that could happen to Trout. But like you said, like, you know, invoking Hank Aaron, I think that's not a bad comp. Like, I could see him just being that consistent, 300, 400, 500 guy for another decade. Like, I think that's really, that's a distinct possibility.
Yeah. It feels to me like the worst outcome, and I don't want to tempt fate here, but, you know, he's been comped to Mickey Mantle his whole career. So maybe the worst outcome is that he has a Mickey Mantle 30s where he's banged up the way Mantle was, although obviously he's much more clean living than Mantle was.
Yeah, I suspect that Mike Trout's personal conditioning habits, we'll see, will lead to him having a gentler decline phase than
one would
imagine.
But even Mantle was worth the 25 war or so from age 30 on. And if you tack that onto Trout's career, then he's a 100 war guy already. And, you know, once you're at that 100 mark, like, you're already an inner circle type player. I mean, there are only like 30 guys in baseball history in that range. So that seems to me like the low outcome for him. And I think, unfortunately, you know, missing the time that he has, whether because of the shortened season last year or because of his own shortened seasons, has probably taken him out of the running to, like, you know, reach the Bonds and Ruth kind of war territory. I mean, you never know, but it would be tough for him to get there. That's such a long timeline.
It's hard to.
Yeah, it's tough to project, obviously. Yeah. And, you know, going after home run records and chasing Bonds and Ruth and that sort of thing, like, it's still well within the range of reasonable outcomes. It's just, I think Zach wrote about that when he got hurt this year. Just, you know, we're losing large slices of his prime years here when he's at his best. And that takes away from the record chases that he might be on, you know, 10 years from now.
I can't get past the insinuation that, like, people say that Mike Trout's boring. Imagine if he turned into Mickey Mantle off the field in his 30s. Like, they wouldn't say he was boring anymore.
That's the thing. I mean, really, like, with all of the off-the-field behavioral issues that so many prominent players have had, like, we're lucky that Trout is what he is. I mean, could he be more scintillating? Could he be a better interview? Could he be a more magnetic personality? Sure, he could. But baseball has a lot of those guys now, and it's not the worst thing to just have like the apple pie all-American type guy who isn't all that interesting, but is, you know, totally unobjectionable and seems like a good role model and signs a lot of autographs for kids and all of that. Like, he's just, he's wholesome, you know, and yeah, he's kind of boring, but we have a lot of entertaining players and some players who have made headlines for all the wrong reasons. So, you know what? It's kind of nice to just have him being the wholesome Trout that he is.
Yeah. When this talk about how long his career's been. This is 4 years ago. I wrote about Trout, the celebrity, and part of him being, I think, like him being boring is part of the reason why, like, there's literally nobody in the world who dislikes him. Like, it's, you know, if you have any kind of personality, if you're, you know, in any way brash, you're going to alienate people. And if you're Trout's in a ton of commercials and stuff, and he does, you know, does a lot of appearances and endorsements. But if you're everywhere, like Michael Jordan was, you know, people are going to get sick of you. And I think he's been really smart. You know, I maintain, like, this is one of the most impressive things about him is how he's leveraged his celebrity to get exactly what he wants out of it and nothing more and nothing less. And I think that's been I don't know if this is cynical enough for it to, you know, for it to be described as a conscious decision, but, you know, I think he's just been very smart about, managing his image or the people around him or, you know, whoever's ultimately making those decisions. But you mentioned like him signing autographs. I think like the images of Trout that really come to mind are, you know, that commercial where he's playing catch with the kid in the stands.
Yeah.
You know, him signing autographs and laughing and, you know, like tossing a baseball to a kid during pregame warmups and stuff. And yeah, that's those are really not iconic, but like those are some of the first images of Trout that come to mind for me, not necessarily golfing that low breaking ball into the seats or chugging down a first or any of the stuff that he does on the field that's so impressive.
Yeah. And I think there's hope for the Angels within the timeline of Mike Trout's peak. You know, I've been watching a lot of Angels baseball, obviously, this season. And yes, they are at 500 again, which it seems they are doomed to be forever. But it's actually pretty impressive that they are 500, given that they've been missing Trout most of the season, that Anthony Rendon, who's now done for the year, has really not been a regular presence up to this point. So a lot of things have gone wrong for them, and yet they are still in their same accustomed place. And now that they've established Otani as this two-way superstar, and who knows if he can sustain that for years to come, but you figure going into next year, if you're counting on Otani to be an approximation of what he was this year, and you have a healthy Trout, and you have a healthy Rendon, and, you know, even in recent days, like, there's been a bit of a youth movement for the Angels, which has been kind of encouraging. And they've had a fallow farm system for most of Trout's career, but it's getting a bit better. And they've called up some guys who've looked pretty impressive. You know, Joe Adell is back now, and it seems like he's really leveled up. And Brandon Marsh is there, and Reed Detmers is there, and he's pretty exciting. And Chris Rodriguez looks pretty good. So, like, there's some young talent there, and it doesn't take that much. Like, if you do
you're
have
such a sucker. I can't believe you're saying,
I know,
you know,
I'm
what
Charlie
I think
Dunn
of when I think
the
of the Angels, I think of Prometheus.
Yes.
Who discovered fire and gave it to humanity and was chained to a rock for all of eternity, where eagles ate his liver every morning and every night his liver grew back so they could eat it again.
That's a fair
Prometheus
comparison.
Starts the Angels in this metaphor, but, and Otani and Trout are fire.
But look, if you have Otani and Trout, and you have Adell, and you have Marsh, and you have Rendon, and you have Jared Walsh, who's broken out this year,
maybe
and you
you'll
have
finish
David 84 Fletcher.
And 78.
They still need pitching.
Something's
going to
happen.
That's a perpetual problem. But mm-hmm. I think there is some hope. And, you know, you mentioned on our outline, like, is there any chance that he gets traded, that he ends up playing for someone other than the Angels? And, it seems like he's content there, at least up to this point. Like
he's chained to the rock.
He chained himself to the rock. You know, he didn't have to stay there forever and sign the biggest dollar contract ever with the Angels, but he seems to be happy there. And they hadn't won for a while when he signed that deal. So I know it seems frustrating for him. And it seems like he's sick of answering the how does it feel to never make the playoffs question year after year after year. So maybe he reaches a breaking point if they just can't put things together. And I don't know, maybe the Angels rebuild or something and they actually do look to move him. Like at this point, I think he is still well worth what he is paid, even though he is paid quite a bit just because he's so great. And obviously that would change maybe as he gets toward the back half of his career and his production tails off a bit. But you'd have to think that, you know, it's not like he's some untradeable albatross or something now. Like he is still well worth his salary. It's just that there aren't that many teams that choose to play in that sandbox when it comes to deals of that size. So, you know, some teams would take themselves out of the running and you could only name so many, but, you know, maybe he can follow the Pujols path and end up with the Dodgers someday and he can be yet another multi-time MVP on that team.
Yeah. So before we get off Trout, I have prepared a game. Since Zach is not here, I'm going to torment you with another game. This game is New Jersey baseball player or New Jersey politician. Mike Trout, of course, being one of the pillars of the pyramid of South Jersey excellence, hailing from Vineland, New Jersey, home of the Palace of Depression. I've learned through some Googling. Vineland is sort of past the dragons on the map that tell you don't go there. But, obviously, I'm very proud to be from the same part of the world as one of the greatest baseball players ever. And so are these people. So I'm going to give you a name. You're going to tell me whether it's a New Jersey politician. New Jersey, by the way, is that place, you know, you go to the one side of Manhattan, you look over the river to the west. You might have seen it off in the fog.
I've been driven through it because I don't drive.
There's a lot of driving in New Jersey. Don't worry. This is not an uncommon experience you've had.
Yes.
It's not the there are chemical, like, you know what Delaware is? Delaware is it's a tax haven punctuated periodically by malodorous chemical plants. And that's the smell you get when you're crossing into New Jersey, at least on the southern end.
I see.
I won't defend the smell of North Jersey.
Okay.
It is Delaware. By the way, like unironically, yes, Delaware's it's Delaware's
odors drifting over New Jersey. I see.
It's true. Mm-hmm. First name, Jim Florio.
Oh,
Jim Florio.
See, that sounds familiar. I'm going to say politician.
Yes, Jim Florio was governor of New Jersey from 1990 to 1994, the last governor from South Jersey, and therefore the last governor who was worth a damn. Second name, John Montefusco.
Oh, baseball.
Baseball player, correct.
Yeah,
pitcher
count.
In the 70s and 80s, possessed of one of the great nicknames in recent baseball history. I guess it's not that recent. The Count of Montefusco.
Yes.
Boardwalk Brown.
Wow, that could go either way. I guess, boy, it sounds like a Peaky Blinders character or something, but I guess that's not an option here. I guess I'll go baseball.
Baseball player. Well, he basically was a Peaky Blinders character because he played for the A's and Yankees from 1911 to 1915, mm-hmm. A native of Woodbury, New Jersey.
Okay.
Bill Dickey. Oh. Bill Dickey.
Hall of Famer. Baseball player.
Yeah, Hall of Fame baseball player, but not from New Jersey.
Oh, no.
Bill Dickey was from Louisiana. It's a trick question. Oh. Bill Dickey was the Speaker of the New Jersey General Assembly
in
1970.
That Bill Dickey.
It's a trick question.
Yeah.
And the last name, Andy Messersmith. Andy Messersmith.
Baseball.
Andy Messersmith. Yes, baseball player, most famous for the Messersmith decision, which inaugurated free agency, born in Toms River, New Jersey.
Yeah. See, this
home of
this game is flawed compared to the college pitcher or actor.
I thought
game.
About using college pitchers.
I've heard of some of these people. That's the problem. But good game. I'm glad I did okay. Although Boardwalk Brown was kind of a guess. But one last point about Trout, because you had one little last bullet point on our agenda. How has he changed the way we think about the game? And I don't know that he's changed the way I think about the game personally, but I do think the way that...
I'm glad you brought that bullet point back in after I was ready to move on to the next segment.
Sorry.
Here's the thing that we weren't going to talk about, but I'm going to talk about anyway, to say it wasn't a good idea to talk about it.
It is important because I think, you know, we mentioned war, or at least I mentioned war several times in this segment, and I don't think that's an accident. Like, Mike Trout is as associated with war as any player is associated with any stat, and I think his rise alongside war's rise in the national baseball consciousness, I don't think it's an accident. I think Trout really helped us appreciate war, and war helped us appreciate Trout. And I've been thinking about that more with Miguel Cabrera closing in on 500 homers and thinking back to those MVP races. And I would bet that they would go differently today, that even if you did have someone going for a triple crown, which who knows, maybe we'll see that come back into play in a couple months with Vlad Jr. and another Angel Shohei Ohtani. But I do think that Trout's success, and especially his success as an all-around player early on, and the way that war made him stand out more so than any of the other back of the baseball card stats did, I think that really helped propel that into, you know, really a household stat that you will see in major mainstream media outlets where it won't have to be explained anymore.
I think that's a good answer. That's not the answer I had prepared, though. Mine was Trout sort of demolished the idea of prospects coming up in their late teens or at age 20 and like needing time to get adjusted to the big leagues, because he was at the front of that Vanguard and Harper too, where they came up in 19 or 20 and just clicked right away. We're all stars or superstars. And then Carlos Correa did it. And then, you know, Vladimir Guerrero and Soto and Tatis. And now, you know, it's fairly common. Like, we almost expect, like, you know, people were crying service time manipulation when the Royals didn't break camp with Bobby Witt. Like, he's completely broken the expectations, or I think, you know, legitimately changed the way we think about the aging curve. So that was going to be.
Yeah. Or when Jared Kelnick or Wander Franco comes up and doesn't set the world on fire immediately, people wonder what's wrong. And that's kind of normal.
Yeah. And, you know, it's sort of, he's sort of like Ruth. I don't know. This is sort of what I remember Bill James writing this about Ruth years and years ago, where everybody thought it was a bad idea to try to hit fly balls, and Ruth proved that it wasn't. And, you know, it doesn't work for everybody, but he proved that it was possible. And I think that Trout did, you know, Trout and some of the players who came behind him proved that it is possible for like a 19 or 20 year old hitter under the right circumstances to break in and tee off on big league hitting. And so, you know, it's not common, but I think it's definitely something we expect or hope for from prospects more than we did 10 years ago.
Yep. That's a good point.
Speaking of New Jersey baseball players, there were two Hall of Fame outfielders from the 30s named after waterfowl, Ducky Medwick and Goose Goslin, both from New Jersey.
Oh, nice.
All right. One quick news item before we go to the unnamed weekend preview segment. Team USA won 7-2 against South Korea at the Olympics. They're going to be playing for a gold medal. Eddie Alvarez is now guaranteed a medal, making him the sixth person ever to medal in both the Winter and Summer Olympics. So congratulations to Eddie Alvarez and Team USA. It's ridiculous, by the way, that we have the bronze medal game and a winner-take-all gold medal game. Like, I know this works out well for Team USA, so I'm not that upset about it. But there's a winner's bracket and a loser's bracket, and the team that comes through the loser's bracket doesn't have to beat the winner's bracket team twice. And that's just not how it should work.
Yeah, I have not consumed a lot of Olympics, as you might expect, but I am planning to watch this gold medal game. And there was a gold medal softball game, U.S. versus Japan, and Japan won that one. So U.S. will try to get
its
revenge
here ourselves
against Masahiro Tanaka, making another start against the U.S. team, because the last U.S.-Japan game, which took place at not the most convenient hour, but that's kind of a staple of these Olympics, but it was a really good game. And so many of the best Japanese players from NPB are playing in the series, just because the NPB took the series. It took some time off so that its players could go play there. But as we've discussed, it's a nice mix of up and coming prospects and remember some guys on the U.S. roster. So I will enjoy that game, I think.
Yeah, I watched the not the Korea game, but the game against Dominican Republic, Scott Kazmir, who grew his hair out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bold move for a man in his late 30s, growing his hair out, shoving against the DR. Tristan Cassis has been really impressive. I think that's somebody who, I don't know, I like that aspect of Olympic baseball where it's a combination of remember some guys and who's this young guy who's, coming in out of nowhere. And I think Cassis might be that guy from this roster, the way like Strasburg or Brett Anderson was on the last Team USA. Mm-hmm. All right. We're going to try to, getting out of here by the top of the hour seems to be, that ship seems to have sailed. So we're going to buzz right through the unnamed weekend preview segment. My pick this week, violating the ordinary don't watch the Red Sox unless you have to rule to highlight Red Sox versus Blue Jays, because so much of the activity at the deadline made sense for teams like the Blue Jays who are out of play, or the Yankees or the Phillies, teams that are just out of playoff spots. Like, they're still in it, but they have to get the work done. And these are big deficits they have to overhaul. And these intradivisional games against teams they're chasing are where you have, where the wheat gets separated from the chaff. So I think this could be, not only because I think it'll be a fun game or a fun series between two good teams, and the Jays have Alek Manoah and Hyunjin Ryu throwing. So like, the games themselves should be pretty good, but also I think this could really be a pivotal series in the AL East race, as the Red Sox have sort of floated back to the pack.
Well, I will stay in the East, but go to the NL, where we have another close race and a good matchup. And it seems like when Zach is here, he is always trying to recommend that people watch the Phillies. And lately, at least, watching the Phillies has been pretty rewarding. And this weekend, they're going up against the Mets. And new acquisition Kyle Gibson will be facing off with Marcus Stroman on Friday. And there is very little separation between these two teams, because the Mets have hit a rough patch and the Phillies have been on a little roll recently. So they're close and they made some moves, and suddenly this is a pretty exciting division race. So looking forward to seeing who comes out on top in this series.
I'll watch that if Bobby's still on vacation. him being away, like I said off the top of the show, has been really good for the NL East race. So yes. Here's hoping he never comes back. All right, that'll do it for this week's edition of the Ringer MLB show. Be sure to follow us on Spotify at Ringer Baseball, where you can catch our shows new every Friday, and the Q Baseball Barbecue every Tuesday with Jake and Jordan. Thanks to Ben for joining me as always. Thanks to Sasha Ashel and Mike Wargon for producing today's episode. Thanks to Mike Trout, Max Scherzer, and Shoeless Joe Jackson for giving us stuff to talk about. And thank you for listening. Enjoy the week's action, and we'll see you next time.
This episode is brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. As a ruthless king builds his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape will fight for the future of apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and in theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. All I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.